here as part of this working group. I do want to point out that there were 8 people in this working group who joined it, who were selected. People nominated themselves, and then a selection process was executed to pick be part of this group. And unfortunately, we didn't put a slide in with people's names on it, and I want to take a moment just to give people credit for having participated. Sarmad Hussain, who is actually ICANN staff now at this point, but when the group started, he wasn't. And so he participated in the early part of this group at this time until he had to resign as part of his new responsibilities when he joined ICANN. We also had Nishit Jain, Naoki Kambi, Jody Kolker, who does actually join me here today, so he'll be part of the discussion that we have after we get our 2 presentations, Takao Suzuki, Dennis Tan, Zheng Wang, and Edmund Chung, all of whom were participants in this particular working group. Okay, so next slide. One of the things that's interesting about talking about the display and submission of registration data is the number of different types of registration data elements that there are. And there are literally hundreds of them if you do a superset of all of the things that are used today in various registries, both in GTLDs and CCLDs, and put all that together. So one of the things that we did first was in deciding how to do our job was we realized that you could take all of these data elements and break them up into categories. So rather than looking at hundreds of data elements, we found that we could identify 12 categories of data elements. And that allowed us to scope our work so that we could focus on requirements for particular categories. And then as data elements come and go, depending on what registries need or other requirements that may or may not come from ICANN and the community at large, they would inherit requirements from the category that they fell into. Or if a new category came about, then it would be easy to set aside some people and time to talk about what new requirements might exist in that new category. So that was one of our first things to do here in grouping by categories. And I'll get in a bit more into the internationalization versus localization as we get into other slides. And of course, we wanted to pay a lot of attention to what else was going on. There's a lot happening, as there always seems to be in the ICANN community and in other communities at large, with respect to internationalization. You know, we're going to hear about the translation and transliteration work in a bit. There was the Directory Services Expert Working Group, which had started many of the efforts which are now in progress. And, of course, the IETF has its set of activities that it was doing in this space, too. So next slide. And I'm concerned, yeah, you downloaded these off the website, and this is not the most up-to-date set of slides. There should only be submission and directory services on this slide. The other two things shouldn't be there. But our scope was to look at the submission and the directory services or display side of internationalized registration data, and then to propose a data model consistent with those requirements as a starting point for the community as it considered the implementation of these internationalization requirements. Next slide. So the first thing that we had done after identifying categories and dividing our elements up into categories, as we started to think about requirements, we realized that there are 3 requirements that are useful or as first principles, and establish them as guiding everything else that we wanted to do. And the first one is the user capability principle. And the significance here is the observation that a user, a registrant, if you will, at the internet at large, should never be required to do more than they are ordinarily skilled at. So whatever your home language or script in use is, that should be what you have to do. You shouldn't, as an individual, be obligated to do any other kind of work. So if there was any work to be done with respect to internationalization, that should fall on the system somewhere in part of the system to figure out how to make that happen. Simplicity and reusability is all about other groups are doing things that are related to internationalization. So, for example, I mentioned the IETF as sort of an external group, and there are standards going on there. We want to take advantage of external standards if they exist and wherever they are, and choose the simplest standard that we could if there were multiple competing standards. That should seem like a fairly obvious thing to want to do. And then, of course, extensibility, you really want to think about the future. We can tell from history that the set of data elements that are part of registration data changes over time because it has changed over the couple of decades almost that this industry has really come into its own and existed. So we need to make sure that whatever we do to the best of our ability doesn't put constraints on what can happen in the future and develop something that, that accommodates those sets of things. So going on to the next slide, I've actually already covered the first point here about registrants only being required to use whatever script or language they're ordinarily skilled at, okay, whatever they would normally do in their day-to-day life. The second item, which is kind of interesting, which comes out of this, and this was partly born out of discussions of translation and transliteration, to the extent that translation and transliteration is going to occur or needs to occur wherever that is supposed to happen, you realize that you cannot effectively do that if you don't know the data that you're working with. You need to understand that data. You need to know certain properties about it. And the two properties that I'll focus on here is you need to know about the language and script in use in some way. So you'll hear a lot more about that when they talk about the translation and transliteration stuff. But for the purposes of this working group, it means that recognizing that you need that information is the requirement. And so that means that the system has to be aware of those things. We use the term tagging in our report. There is a paragraph in the report which explains the little sub-bullet that's here, and that's why I put it up here. It's actually a very important sub-bullet. Some people will take the tagging word and immediately associate that with the idea that I somehow, with each of the data elements as an implementation requirement, have to mark the fact that this data, I know what its script and its language is and those kinds of things. It's important in our report to understand we're not trying to be prescriptive in that way. The requirement is simply that that information be available and known in some, with some deterministic certainty. And with that in mind, we use the term tagging to refer to that requirement, and the actual implementation of it is still left for future work and decisions and choices. Next slide. So along the way, we discovered that we had to make a choice. We were either going to give advice about what you should do today to internationalize registration data and the full suite of that, or what we ultimately decided to do was to consider what would be the ideal place that we would like to be. You know, what should really exist in this world? If we could, you know, throw everything away almost and start over, what would you like internationalization to really look like? What would that really mean to the community? And so we chose the model of, since we're an expert working group and it's just our role to provide advice and recommendations for the community to then evaluate and decide where they want to go with, that we would take the model of looking at an ideal kind of situation and describe what we think the industry should look like and what circumstances should look like. And having done that, we identified a number of technical challenges that exist in the world today. So it would not be possible to immediately transition to supporting full internationalization. And these are some of the things that we had identified along the way that would make that difficult. The first, of course, is the EPP protocol itself, that basic protocol, which is the interaction between registries and registrars. It is the primary protocol used. It's certainly used in all GTLDs, and most CCTLDs use it today also. But there are certain technical features that are missing from that protocol if you're going to fully deploy internationalization. And we identify those things here. The lack of a language and script attribute, the lack of a fine-grained language and script attribute. So EPP is based on an underlying encoding mechanism, XML. And it, of course, does have features for tagging, for providing some script and language information. But what you find if you look in the details of our report is that that's not fine-grained enough. There's an object level that to which those language and script attributes apply, and that's not sufficient to support full generalization in the internationalization context. So that's something the community has to evaluate. How far do you want to go down this path? There's also the issue of a conversion mechanism. And what that refers to is if you do translation or transliteration, you somehow have to note that. You need to make that visible in some way that has to be part of the data. And then there's a relationship that has to happen between the original data and the converted data. And that's all part of this conversion mechanism attribute, and that information does not currently exist. So these are issues that will have to be, you know, asked and discussed and understood by the community. There's the question of the who is protocol. This issue is mostly solved because you do have RDAP as a replacement protocol for who is. So the directory services problem, to the extent the proper internationalized data exists at the registry, and the registry provides the directory services, if RDAP is the protocol that's used, then, you know, there are mechanisms in place for dealing with internationalization. But at the time that we started this work, the RDAP protocol development was also just beginning in the IETF. So we kind of had we both came to closure at a similar time. So the timing here was such that we just left this requirement in here and noted it, Paige. So we observe in the report, too, that if you're going to tag data in some way with respect to its script and language, then you need standardized tables of languages and scripts, not just the names of those languages and scripts, but the content of them. And that, in fact, does not exist. Even within individual countries or, you know, sovereign states, even they don't always know exactly what their language is. They just have variations and variants and things like that. So there are issues there. We also observe that in full support of internationalization, there are workflow changes that would probably be required at a registrar. Given that a registrar is the facing point, the entry point to registrants, in order to properly take in internationalized data, registrars have things that they have to do in order to be able to include all of this tagging or have knowledge about it, and the way in which they might interact with registrants. And there's also the postal address issue. You realize that we talk in detail about the fact that the Western convention of, you know, a name, address line 1, address line 2, you know, city, state, postal code, is really not an appropriate address system for the world at large. Those aren't really what the standards are. I mean, if you look at the UPU standards for what is a valid address or what is a functioning address, it does not actually require all of those components. So it's just something that one has to think about in terms of how you build your system. Where do you really want to go and how you're going to support those things? And then finally, on this page, we have the issue of internationalized email addresses. It's fairly obvious and, you know, straightforward to suggest that we should support internationalized email addresses. Well, you know, they haven't seen broad deployment, unfortunately, in that space. And so that becomes an issue, or the deployment tends to be rather localized. So you have regional deployments of internationalized email addresses. And functionally, they're not operationally backwards compatible. If you're going to fully support them, given that email systems is by definition a store and forward service, there are players in your email delivery who may not be directly associated with you or, in fact, the final destination. And so you have issues of them having an upgraded system in order to support it, as well as changes. I mean, if you're the registrar facing a registrant, you know, you have to support that registrant in an internationalized email address. There are some real changes that have to happen there, not just on your interface, but in your email system and your ability to deliver those messages and use them. So that's a technical issue that needs to be considered. Moving on, localization versus internationalization. We developed these terms and you know, started using them. The important point here is that internationalization simply means that the data can easily be converted, and converted meaning translated or transliterated for its local audience, for whoever wants to use it. So the way to understand that is there is no single internationalized form of an address. You wouldn't say something like, you know, English in U.S. ASCII is the internationalized form of contact information or registration information for the internet. Really, whatever form you take the data in represents an internationalized form. What you need from an internationalized form is that it is sufficiently identified, for example, with tagging, so you know the script and language in use, so that you can convert it to whatever local form is necessary, whatever the recipient or whatever the consumer of that data needs to use. That's the requirement. So it's not about the actual details, syntax of the data itself that you're using. It's about what you can do with it. That's the distinction between internationalization and localization. And we have in our document an example that we created, which shows that, you know, the internationalized form can be whatever it needs to be, whatever you take from the registrant, and the local form can be, at some point, you're going to translate or transliterate that and thus present it to whatever its consumer needs to be. Next slide. So the next thing that we did was to look at a data model and put together a proposal just for discussion, because, again, there are limitations to the ability to use this data model. Especially given the technical limitations in EPP, this data model would not be directly applicable. You couldn't immediately deploy it, because even if a registrar or a registry wanted to use it, you would have no way to pass it between them, you know, in the current state of the system. But we created a model and tried to accommodate all of the things that aligned with the requirements that we had laid out here. And these are the objects that are defined in the registration data model: domain objects, contact objects, registrars, and name servers. And I won't go into the details of those here. For the most part, that should be fairly well understood if you're part of the system and you work with this. So the next slide. And this is just a summary of the requirements that would be required in order to display the data. So what's important as a player that's part of the system, registrar, registry, and other players in this, is what you need in your system is to ensure that you don't put up barriers to localization. So this means that a registrant should be able to enter whatever language or script they want to use. You need to communicate with them in whatever way is convenient for them. That's the user capability principle right up front. And for display purposes, you need to make sure that you can pass through the data, whatever it is that you got. It's properly marked, tagged, or represented in a way that the consumer can then localize the data and manipulate it in a way that's useful to them. So you need to provide and set yourself up to have all of the necessary features to allow all of these things to occur. Okay, slide. This is a list of the high-level requirements that we had put. What we did in creating the requirements in the document, in the categories, was we observe, again, that there's a set of requirements that applies throughout for all of the data elements. And then we, in a table, listed specific requirements for individual categories of data elements. So the first one is the one we've actually talked about multiple times here. Registrant should only be required to use a language or script with which they're ordinarily skilled. A registry, it seems to make sense, must be prepared to accept and store and then offer for display purposes pretty much any language or script that might reasonably be expected to be used in their target markets. Okay. And then, of course, you always need to have knowledge of the language and script that is appropriate for the data element that you're working with. Okay? It doesn't mean that it necessarily has to be physically tagged with it and stored with it, but you do need to have that information available to you in some way in your implementation. Next slide. This is just a list of the 12 categories. And I'll only call out a couple here just to point out. So we had those high-level requirements that would apply to everything. And then specific requirements would include things like when you get down to the phone and fax numbers, you know, there are other organizations that define what a phone number is supposed to look like in the syntax of that. So we simply refer to those kinds of documentation in terms of what those should look like. Email addresses would be the IETF standard for internationalized email addresses. DNSSEC is a similar thing. You know, the IETF has specified requirements on what DNSSEC information must exist and what needs to be there. So we simply refer to those standards. And next slide, this is the example of if I could have on the left-hand side here an example of directory services output, which would be suitable for a Japanese audience. And in the right-hand side, it represents the same data or a version of the same data, which has been variously translated or transliterated, depending on, you know, for this particular tool here, for an English-speaking audience. And these things are lined up in tended to reflect the same data on the left and right. And real point to be made here is just that you can see both of these things, you know, independent of what actually is stored on the back end. If you know enough about the data and you've properly paired your systems, then these kinds of things are possible. And the next slide, please. This is a little bit more about next steps and recommendations and technical challenges for the current system, so for people to be aware of. Registrars in particular, you know, they are the first facing representative to the registrant and the internet community. So that's the place where you first have to figure out what the script and language is in use and figure out if you need to have that information, how you're going to get that, and how you're going to make that part of the rest of the system. And you get into this issue of what exactly is the data model? So where is the script and language information going to be stored and how? And if that information has to be put in place in some way, the registrars would have that responsibility. This functionality doesn't exist, and so this needs to be considered. The second thing, of course, is that there are obviously differences even today between registry agreements, you know, registrar agreements, and I think we know this, and there's some of these activities are already in progress. There's a lot of activity now to harmonize this kind of stuff, and even moving from to everyone being a thick registry, all registries being thick. And this kind of stuff applies mostly on the GTLD side, but again, in a full internationalized context, even CCTLDs, you know, need to consider if they're going to move in a direction where the GTLDs are so that we can have, you know, harmonization and the community at large can be better served by having uniform access to data. And we have the PDP on translation transliteration. They'll be talking about that later, so I will leave that alone for right now. And the next slide. These are the specific steps that our working group had come up. Given the suggested recommendations that we have and the technical challenges that we were able to identify as part of our work, we listed the following specific suggestions on things that the community needs to look at and questions that need to be answered as it considers where it wants to go, what the transition plan is. So we've described an end goal. We've described a place for the community to be in this context, and these are the questions that need to be answered in order to get to that place. So part of what the community has to evaluate is how close to this end goal does it want to get, or does it believe it can get, or even should it get to? You know, I mean, perhaps there's just things you're going to decide that really don't want to do for, you know, any number of different reasons. Okay. So finally, the next slide. This is just a reference to some additional work that's been going on, and this actually is the last slide. The rest of the slides that are in here is the specific data elements and the categories. And if you just taste in the next one, just to give people a taste of what's there, it just shows you in particular for the categories of data elements the particular requirement that we had laid out. So the only thing I gave above was the three principles that apply to everything, and then these are more detailed requirements for each of the individual categories of data elements. And I won't really go through those here. You can look at detail in the report. So, and that's it.
To the next slides. There we go. Now we're going to move on to the second part of the presentation relating to the recommendations from the final report on translation and transliteration. We have Chris Dillon and Rudy Vaznik here to talk about that. They were the co-chairs of that EDP. And just so you all are aware, those recommendations were adopted by the ICANN board just recently. So they are officially policy, and we're moving into the implementation stage for these recommendations.
Thank you very much. Next slide, please. So there are our two charter questions. So first of all, whether it's desirable to translate or transliterate contact information into a single common language or script, and then who should decide, who should get the burden of doing it? Well, the policy decision was that it shouldn't be done, so actually we can almost ignore that second thing. But what I will do just briefly is explain translation and transliteration. So if you were looking at an address, what you probably wouldn't want to do is translate the whole of it, because, you know, you'd end up with things like Tokyo becoming Eastern Capital, and you have something which is ridiculous. Likewise, if you do a pure transliteration, then that works. So you get your address into a form that, you know, people can use and understand. But you will have things like you might be looking for Bangkok, but you'll be getting Krung Thep instead. So you get these sort of situations where things slip. And also things like, you know, probably the original data has things like road and street in it and, you know, in the local languages, and you will not be getting that, whereas it might be often helpful to have those things translated. So eventually we used the word transformation, which would either mean pure transliteration or transliteration with a bit of translation mixed in with it. So just to be really precise about that, because I know there was some questioning about that relatively recently. And then down here, actually we can ignore the timeline. I think we know where we are. And so here we have, you know, various issues that were picked up. Huge problems with the lack of standards with many languages. Some languages, Japanese has about 3 different transliteration standards, for example. Other languages don't have them at all. They'd need to be created. So, expense, because, for example, to get a nice quality record, like the example in the slide that Jim was displaying a moment ago, it's fairly clear that there has to be quite a lot of manual intervention there. I mean, transliteration you might get to work if it was Cyrillic language or Greek or some sort of alphabetic language which actually writes all its vowels down. That always helps. But many situations where it wouldn't, where it really wouldn't work at all. Then there is actually another important issue is actually about usability. So, you've got your transliterated or your transformed record, but actually the people you're trying to contact don't understand English anyway, so it doesn't really matter whether you email them in it. I've forgotten to say next slide. And I think there are relatively few things I want to pick up here. Certainly, although the decision is taken that we are recommending that there won't be transformation, there might be parties who want to transform things at some stage. Now, if they don't know what language that those data are in, then they can't transform. So that's really where that issue comes from. And there was then a bit of a debate about whether just sort of sticking Japanese on the as language of the contact information would work, or whether you actually had to go right through each field and say, well, this one's Japanese, but what if the Japanese address has Arabic numerals or worse, Roman alphabet in it? These things can happen. So it might be acceptable just to call it Japanese, but that would then include a few other things that aren't really Japanese. If it was very, very difficult to tag each field, then maybe that could be a fallback position, perhaps. Okay, and next slide, please. Well, I told you already what the main recommendation was, and it's basically not to transform for the various reasons we were talking about. And then, actually, we've also spoken about the second main recommendation is that at least, if they're not transformed, it is important that we know what language they're in. The thing is that if original data is used, it needs, it does need to be consistent and, obviously verified. If transformation is performed, it should be indicated that a transformation has happened. And also, I think there's a necessity to indicate what was the original version. So this is a case where I would probably like to say to you that the original version, the master version, so it's the main version, what is the authoritative version of these data, I would like to say that usually you're better off with it in your original language. So like in our Japanese example,
I would really want Japanese script, because there are going to be all sorts of ambiguities in the transformed Englishy or ASCII version of that. So that might be a might be interested in. Okay, I think there's nothing else I want to pick up there. There was also a minority view, which basically said the IPC was keen that the data be transformed, and these were this slide is the reasons they gave. Then there's an information slide, which is on the next. The next one is just sort of basically where you find all of these various reports, and then we're done. Now, what did I miss out, Rudy?
Well, I first have to say that it was great to have, in fact, not a chair, but working with two co-chairs for different reasons. And one of the essential reasons is that Chris is a linguistic specialist, and for understanding translation and transliteration, you need to understand the language issues first of all. And we had a great group. Pitanen was also part of the team. We had a very good group. Jim was also taking part in it. Chris has been focusing essentially on the real linguistic issues. I'm rather looking into the techniques, and we had a lot of exchange and discussions on how is this implementable at the end. If there is no field available to indicate what kind of original language and translated language you could use, we have looked into how registrars are offering a platform to allow eventually a registrant to translate or transliterate information in the HUIS. That has been taken in consideration to say that at the end we could not recommend that it is mandatory, because there are a lot of technical issues that are not solved today, and before they will get solved, it will take some time. And we knew that there was, from the expert working group, that there are several ideas of having a broader data model that would allow us to eventually move forward. We have been checking even with tools to see if, for instance, a Google Translation could be a good platform to be used to help registrants to translate. But at the end, the WHOIS is also data that is used by law enforcement. And you have to give the guarantee that the data that is in the WHOIS is correct. If you start translating based on Google Translation, for instance, we did some trials. We ended up in places where you could not deliver post. So I think that it's not just a linguistic issue. It's also a technical issue that we try to look upon. And indeed, the implementation of our recommendations now, as the board has validated and resolved, will take some time, because we have to guide and give directions to ideas in how eventually in the future being able to translate and store, because that's the other issue. You have to store the data, and how is this going to be done? That's another point. So that has been taken in the whole timing and the plan that we had. We have been working more than 12 months on this. with weekly calls. And I have to say, I'm technically very well aware of the EPP issues that will be raised again when we are going into a deeper discussion. I learned a few things that you quite often will forget when you just look upon WHOIS. You look at the address data that you find and say, okay, well, I can use it and put it in a Google Translation or whatever. I will find a way to get it. But at the end, it's not that easy. And we have to make clear that it's not just the registrant. There is the registrar, but there's also the registry. You have three players in this game. And that's one of the reasons why we felt that we could not oblige people to go through this very difficult process of translating or transliterating.
Thank you for that. Your mention of Google Translate, not that it's, for some languages it's actually very good, but just shame it doesn't do more, reminded me of one other important issue that came up regularly during our meetings, and this was sometimes there were people who would say things like, can we not just get volunteers to transform these data for us? And the answer is no, because the problem is that you end up with them transforming it this way according to one system, that way according to another, or preferably you're using about three systems all at the same time. You end up even with one language, all kind. We shouldn't even use the word standard. Please, whatever happens, let us not go there. I think that was the only thing I thought of as you spoke.
Thank you very much. So now we'll move on to the next topic. This is related to the IETF work to come up with a new protocol to replace the current port 43. And we have Francisco Arias from ICANN to talk about that.
Thank you, Margie. My team in ICANN works in the areas called technical services within the Global Domains Division. That means we work on the technical specifications and other technical issues related to both GTLD registries and registrars. So regarding enabling internationalization in the... Oops, I thought I was changing it in... Yes, next slide. Thank you. So talking about enabling internationalization in directory services in GTLDs as... my predecessors in the microphone already mentioned port 43 or WHOIS. It's not as internationalized. It has no support at all for internationalization. As a matter of fact, the RFC where the WHOIS protocol is defined, it clearly says that it is not internationalized. And so that is a characteristic that is missing. Next slide, please. And then if you want to add, for example, language tags to WHOIS, there is another issue there. There is no standardized format. There is no defined set of fields that are in the protocol. So it will be difficult to get people to understand what the language tag is for each of the elements in WHOIS. Next slide, please. And there is another set of issues why you want to change WHOIS, but that are probably not related to the topic at hand in regards to internationalization of registration data, but that are here just for reference. So with this in mind, a few years ago, we started looking, the community here at ICANN started looking at what should be done. Next slide, please. So I believe in 2010 we started with the first organizing in ICANN a series of discussions on what should be done, what would be the a way to move forward. And then in 2011, ESAC published SAC 51 advisory, in which, among other things, it was requesting the replacement of the WHOIS protocol to something that was, among other things, able to support internationalized registration data. Later, the board adopted that resolution. The board adopted that advice, and staff was tasked to implement those recommendations. Among those, one to develop a roadmap to implement the ESAC advice, and that eventually. Give birth within the ITF, the community, their registries, registrars, and other interested people to what was called the WIRTS working group that just early this year in March published the ERDA protocol, Registration Data Access Protocol, which is the intended replacement for WHOIS protocol. And at the time, we also, at ICANN Staff, were working with registries and registrars, and we already have contractual provisions in some of the legacy GTLDs. You will see Almost all of the big ones have it already in their agreements, a provision to implement RDAP when requested. And also new ETLDs and 2013 RAA registrars also have the such requirement to implement RDAP once they are requested. So when are we going to request this? Next slide, please. This is the our current timeline of when this could happen. Right now, we published a few weeks ago what we call the GTLD RDAP profile. This is a document that is mapping the contractual and policy requirements on GTLD registries and registrars to RDAP. RDAP as a protocol in the ITF, it's you can think of it more of a framework or a menu where you choose what to implement. And so we thought there was a necessity to have a document that will specify for GTLD registries and registrars the minimum set of functionality for RDAP that has to be implemented in order to comply with their contractual and policy requirements. So that's the document that we published, the RDAP profile, and we currently have it. We publish in an open mailing list called GTLD Tech at ICANN. If you're interested, you can search it and find it. It's an open mailing list; anyone can join. And currently, there is discussion on this first draft that we publish. We hope to close the discussion by mid November, and then publish the. An updated version of this profile for a period of formal public comment, which we think will end in January. And then by the end of January, publish the final version of the this RDAP profile. And then we will be formally requesting ETLD registries and registrars, at least those that have the contractual provision, to implement RDAP and given the commitment that we have with contractor parties to an implementation calendar that allows contractor parties to have 6 months, at least 6 months to implement new requirements. Then if we publish in January, then the requirement will be to publish by the end of July. So let's say August to have it working. I must say there are a couple things that need to be added to RDAP to enable all the functionality that is described in the GTLD registry and registrar agreements and census policy. So there are a couple fields that need to be added that are not in the base RDAP specification. There is already a couple drafts addressing that issue. We don't expect that to be a big problem. And there is another functionality that needs to be added regarding searchable whois, but that's a specialized form of whois that only certain GTLD registries implement. So that can be solved later. We don't expect that to be an issue for the majority of the GTLD registries and registrars. So this is the current timeline. If all goes well, we could be having RDAP implemented in the GTLD space by... August next year. That's the current timeline. And I believe I have another slide on this. Do I? Oh, yes, of course. We have a session on RDAP, and you're more than welcome to join this Wednesday. There is a date, and we will be discussing the RDAP in more detail, particularly on the RDAP profile, where we are and what is still missing to be defined and agreed so that we can move forward. With that, thank you.
So now the next phase of this discussion is a panel discussion among all our panelists about some of the next steps for both the IRD and the translation and transliteration policy that just was adopted. And with that, we'll kick off with some questions, I think, and once we get through the questions, we'll open it up to the floor to see if anyone in the audience has questions as well. Next slide, please. Okay. So our first question is, what do you think the next steps should be for the IRD report in light of the adoption of the new translation and transliteration policy by the board? And some sub-questions among that are there any IRD recommendations that require further policy work? And if so, which ones are they? So I'd like to...
So this is Jim. I was going to say, I think since I gave the presentation, I'll let Jody go first here and answer a question.
Well, I believe the next is a PDP working group to decide whether this policy actually should be carried forward and approved by the GNSO. But I think we've left some open questions in there to be debated by the PDP itself. These are recommendations, but they're not actually policy.
So which are the policy questions that, like, specifically, and that seem to be ones that the GNSO should focus on?
The proposed requirement the language in the script needs to be sent along with the various elements, and that those elements, once a registrant enters their addresses, if that is supposed to be within the regional or the official language of the region that the registrant actually lives in, or what they put for their address.
Jim?
So let me just add a little more context to one thing that Jody said. In the detailed requirements there for the address category of things, we stated in our requirement that the language and script that's used for the address should be appropriate for the region in which the address is located. And that's an interesting requirement when you step back and you think about it. What exactly does that mean and why it should be anything in particular? In the spirit of, can you tag the data? You know, you immediately get into this question of, do I know what the language and script is that's likely to be used? As long as you're not going to require translation and transliteration, which, you know, we already had the policy that said no, we got several comments both during the early comment period and in the final comment period, even for our report, where people objected to this idea that the language and script should be appropriate for the region. But you have the issue of, is there a standard language or script? How do I know, you know? Well, take it one step at a time. I'm sorry. First is the question of, how do I know what the language or script is that's in use? How am I supposed to get that information? Where does that come from? So that becomes an interesting implementation question in this space. You get a partial answer from the code points and the data that you get, because the code points themselves, if you look them up in Unicode, tell you what the script is that it belongs to. But how do you turn that into knowing what language is in use? I don't know. I mean, there are options here, but these are issues that policy group has to look at. You have to think about what it means to implement some of these requirements and why you would want to have them. I think that as a common sense kind of thing, it feels right, at least it always did to me as a personal bias, to suggest that an address should be in its local language or script or whatever is there. There are people who feel very strongly that no, you know, it needs to be in a single language or script, and somebody has to translate and transliterate it and stuff like that. So I think that's an interesting and a very, you know, dramatic almost issue, policy question that needs to be asked. If that's going to be the requirement, what exactly does that mean on the implementation side? How far do you take that? And I, you know, we had many discussions in our working group about what the answer to that question should be. And we ultimately realized that although we were looking at it as objectively and neutrally as we could, you realize that there's a very big industry out here and a lot of people. There are a lot of other opinions that should be accounted for, and people should have an opportunity to really think about what it means to do this. And I think that's part of what you get out of the policy process is much broader participation, much broader types of input. And, you know, a lot of people should be able to talk about this issue and what they think about it and where it should go. Other than that, I agree with everything that Jody said. So thank you.
May I ask a follow-up question? Did Rudy or Chris, did the translation or transliteration group address some of those issues or talk about them, even if they didn't end up in their final report?
We were in constant contact. Jim actually attended, I think, a majority of our meetings. And yes, we did, over a period of about 18 months, I think, pick up many, many aspects.
Roger Carney, GoDaddy. I found it interesting you said acceptable and then a requirement for regional scripts. And then doesn't that go against your first principle that it's dependent on the person. So that person would not necessarily have to fit into the regional knowledge base.
So, Jim, here, to cast this into a concrete example, I think the example specifically that you're referring to is, you know, I'm an individual, I'll use myself, you know, I'm an American, I speak English, that's really all I work with and all I've ever done. And I moved to, let's make it especially dramatic, I moved to China, okay? And so, you know, I know nothing about Chinese, traditional or anything else. You know, would I be able to enter my address? Would I, as a registrant, be able to go to a Chinese registrar and enter an address for, in particular, address information and put it there? I think in practical terms, the only observation that I make about that, I mean, it's a fair question to ask. If the address is supposed to be in the local region and I have no competency in that address in producing those kinds of characters, what would I do? I only observe as a practical matter that it's probably, I think, my own personal bias here, reasonable to say, well, I ought to be able to copy and paste from something. I mean, clearly I live somewhere, so I clearly know what my address is and what it looks like for some reason. You know, somebody told me that this is what my address is and they wrote it down for me or something, I would think. So as a practical matter, I ought to be able to copy and paste that over and do it and put that in. And so I ought to be able to do that, and that should happen. Yeah, that's manual. It seems contrary to the idea that I should only have to enter English if that's all I know. But I want to be careful to not take that particular requirement too far and make it too absolute. So these become the interesting case studies or scenarios one walks through as you develop the requirements. But this is why, since you highlight this example, why you look at things like the name versus the address field, and we develop separate categories for the name versus the address field. Because you have the observation on the other side, which is somebody's name, they should be allowed to enter their name, whatever it is. So the name requirement is free-form text, absolutely no restrictions whatsoever on what goes there, because that's the right thing to do for the registrant. I should only be able to enter whatever I know and am ordinarily skilled at. I know what my name is. I shouldn't be obligated to turn it into something that you know, because that's not my problem, right? The address, yeah, there's sort of a little bit of an extra requirement beyond the idea that it should just be appropriate for the region and beyond the idea that I should only have to enter what I'm skilled at. Does that answer your question? Thank you.
Maybe to continue what Jim was mentioning, we may not forget the objective of the contact information. It is normally a way of having the ability to contact the registrant. In how many cases are we still sending a letter to a registrant? The only purpose at the end is a legal purpose of contacting. If you want to claim an action against the registrant, you need that official address. Still, the question is it the legal address that is entered? That's the other issue. So I think it's something where there will be a lot of work needed in order to clarify what is the real data in the WHOIS in itself. How much data is real and how much data is just because people didn't understand what to enter. I'm taking cases of having registrars that are offering you a good price for registering a domain name, but you don't understand the language in itself of the form where you're entering your data, could end up in entering data that is incorrect. So I think, and that's coming through the translation and transliteration work we have been doing, that popped up also. From how do you do if you don't understand the form that is in front of you? That's the initial point where you enter the data already.
And just to comment on the copy and paste, that seems to make sense, you know, that would be doable. But, I mean, I think that enters in some security issues of you getting a wrong address and your mail going somewhere else, or even compliance issues when you say, yeah, just copy it and paste it into the registrar portal, and guess what? Now you have a WHOIS claim against you because it's wrong, and you can't even prove it's right or wrong, so...
State your name, please.
Yeah, Christopher Wilkinson. James, fascinating. Thank you. You had a slide with 12 data elements and an illustration of a translation and transliteration into Japanese. Is it the proposal that all 12 data elements would be publicly available on the Whois or would that be restricted to the registrar?
Just so I understand, I think the question you're asking me is this working group suggesting that for any particular directory service, it should always show all 12 of those data elements? And the answer to that would be no. Yeah. That would be subject to some other policy which was outside of our scope and discussion.
Yeah, because I envisaged the situation where different jurisdictions would have different standards as to what data would be publicly available. So that's... And related to that, is there any issue, for example, with one or two countries who have announced their intentions of ensuring that all relevant data is stored locally? What happens if you have a Whois a database in Cyrillic and and the registrar can't move the data legally anyway?
So, again, for the context of this presentation, the answer there is, you know, we are not prescriptive in terms of implementation details, and not being prescriptive in terms of guidance based on laws or regulations and profiles that might be developed, such as the RDAP profile that Francisco had talked about, you know, for that in terms of display. Think of our report more in the following terms. We were developing recommendations for internationalization of registration data. So the idea is, if you are going to allow the submission of internationalized registration data, this is the way it should look and the way that you need to handle it. If you're going to display it, these are the kinds of issues that you need to account for and the things that you need to do. The answer to that if question is outside the scope of our work and subject to other, bodies and et cetera.
Yeah, thank you. I just sort of see the problem coming.
Do you have a question?
I'm Jeff Noakes. I'm with Semantic in California, the SSL PAI part of Semantic. And point you brought up that you described as a small use case about you going to China and trying to enter this, we're already seeing three variations of that. So one is a large company like Bank of America will have a small team of people that do this globally, right? And so my job is to do that. As a single language speaking American, I will never know how to do that in China or Russian or any. The second use case is sometimes large companies outsource this process, somebody like a Mark Monitor or something like that. And they, for labor purposes, will push that labor to India or China or Brazil or someplace like that. And these people won't know how to do that. And then the third use case we're seeing, and the issuer, we're highly dependent on the accuracy of this data, right? The third use case are, for lack of cyber squatters, who mint domain names everywhere, you know, thousands per day, right? And by and large, these people sort of skirt on playing by the rules, right? And the minimal amount of information will be in there. So those are three problems that we're seeing. And, you know, soon, and the guys from GoDaddy will know this real well, soon after that they get the domain name, the next thing comes the SSL certificate, right, that's based some part on this Whois data.
I can give you a response in terms of just my perspective based on what you said, but did you have a question there? I don't think I heard a question. You were making a comment?
Question is I hope that this can be considered in the outcome, whatever the recommendation will be.
So I'll just say that I agree with you. You know, I mean, there are – I don't even want to call it edge cases since you, you know, casually called me suggesting that I gave a small use case in my example. I did not intend to diminish my example in any way or downplay the significant issue here. The fact of the matter is internationalization is hard. Given that we have an existing legacy system, and we just have a huge multi-billion-dollar industry built up around this stuff, and it's been around for decades now at this point, you know, moving to any kind of ideal situation and circumstances is significantly non-trivial. I mean, that simply cannot be understated. You've identified a few more cases, and there are other cases. I mean, we had a number of discussions in our working group about different kinds of scenarios and how things might work and the stuff that could come up. I suspect that this whole issue is going to fall into the cliched, if you will, you know, 80-20 kind of thing. You know, we're going to figure out what the 80% of the world is that we can solve. And I'm sorry, but at least for the foreseeable future, 20% are going to be, you know, they're going to come in the next generation, whatever that is. You know, and I think, so Margie, when you had asked up front, you know, what are the policy questions, you know, in any, for any particular policy question that comes up, I think that each of those individual groups are going to have to ask themselves the question, what is the 80% problem I'm going to solve? Because I'm really not going to be able to solve all of it. So you have to figure out how much you can solve and then agree that you're all going to do it this way and solve that much problem and get that over with. And I think that there are multiple, you know, problem spaces here, and those will have to be sorted out, and they might be divided up into different groups, or they might be one big group. You know, those are all sort of process questions, if you will. Thanks.
Thank you. So let's move on to the next question. Are there any inconsistencies between the recommendations in the IRD report and the translation and transliteration report, or do you feel that they're both compatible?
Well, I already mentioned in the other report there is the statement, something like, there is no single internationalized form, which... As I was saying earlier, I really prefer the local, you know, the local form, and then because you can derive other forms from it, but it may well have aspects to it which are special. And the example of that, just briefly, was in the Japanese record that was displayed. It was the word first building, and you might think that you would be able to take first building and go straight into Japanese, and actually you can. So you'd look at that and you'd probably think something like, well, it's probably going to be Daiichi Biru. It might be Daiichi Biru Dingu, but something like that. In fact, it's worse, because the word first and the English word fast, they're the same in Japanese. Both of them could be faster, because actually the Japanese wasn't Daiichi Biru, as I was expecting. It could even have been other things. It was actually Fasto Biru, which, you know, there was just no way you could predict that. All they did was just repeat the English, but you didn't know that was what was going to happen. Now, going back the other way, if you go from Fasto Biru into English, you can either go to first building or fast building. There's no way of knowing. So that's why, and I'm pretty sure that whatever examples you gave me, I'd be finding similar things. That's why I still reckon that the local is actually in some ways better. But whether that actually affects policy, you know, which is developed in the future, I don't know. I really hope it doesn't. As far as I'm aware, it may not do. But I feel, because the question is there, I have to answer it honestly. But it may be that this just ends up being a footnote, and actually it has no effect in the future. I hope that's the case.
Jim or Jody, do you have any comment?
I mean, Chris and I had multiple conversations about this particular issue. And in fact, he had submitted specific comments during the comment period about what we had done in the report. And we did try to reflect an answer, you know, in a footnote. And I think you did acknowledge at one point that the footnote was okay for now.
I like it very much. Thank you.
But it highlights, I mean, I don't think it represents an inconsistency per se. I mean, I prefer to think of it as emphasizing or highlighting the fact that translation and transliteration is a hard process, you know, and in that context, as he refers to taking in the localized form, that's where the user capability principle comes in. The user should be able to enter their local form, whatever that is, and that's what should be considered, you know, the default. And the idea is, whatever that is essentially the internationalized representation, because as long as you have enough information about it, you have context and you know the language and script, you can then convert that into whatever else you want. And that's, you know, what you're trying to achieve. Whether you can do it in an automated way or not, or we're into this 80-20 kind of discussion, that's, you know, a whole different set of issues.
This is Roger Carney. Chris, and when you say local, you mean registrant choice, not local. If I was living in China, I would think local meant put it in Chinese.
Yeah, this is going, yes, exactly. So what I am saying is that if you have an address which is down a small alley in Tokyo somewhere, I really feel that having that address in Japanese script, you've an advantage because what in English is just represented in a particular way could be represented in the worst case I know is actually 22 different ways in Japanese. But, you know, that script holds data that the Roman alphabet doesn't, and also the other way around. Sometimes the Roman script holds data that cannot be represented on the other side. So that, you know, the example that in English we have a distinction between fast and first, but they don't have that distinction in Japanese. So I feel that the script, if you were somewhere like Singapore, you would have four possibilities, if you think, you know, anywhere in Singapore. That is actually in some way better.
Okay, then let's move to the last one. IRD report recommendations were to become policy, what are the technical challenges you foresee? I think you may have addressed some on some of the slides. Are there any others you want to highlight?
I might be summarizing them again, but the first one is that when a customer or a registrant enters in their data, there is no way to verify that the regional language, there's no ISO documentation on this is the local script and language that should be used for this region. So it'll be a best guess, basically, unless there an ISO standard comes out, and then each registry and registrar needs to use that ISO list, and that just doesn't exist right now. The other problems are, I already covered them, is that EPP does not allow you to send in language and script with every element that would be in the who is or the data elements. The third issue would be, some registries are not allowing you to enter in UTF-8 right now. You can only enter in ASCII to send those. So all of those things would have to change in order to implement something like this.
Does anyone want to raise any other technical issues? May I ask a question about the changes to EPP? Is it possible to change EPP to address this, or is that really too difficult to attempt?
This is Francisco. So yes, it's possible. As a matter of fact, EPP, just like RDAP, was designed to be extensible. The E for EPP actually means extensible. So you can define an extension that could address adding the tags in the bold so that can be transmitted. I think the technical side is probably the easiest side to solve here. I think it's more complicated to define who is going to define what goes in that tag. It's the registrant, the registrar, the registry, or someone else. In the RDAP side, there is good news. RDAP, being a new protocol, already has support for the language tags. And we did a preliminary analysis, and it seems most of the details in the IRD report can be addressed in regards to language tags, except for a couple of fields in the address, because the way it works in RDAP, you have one language tag for the full address, while the IRD was recommended to have three separate language tags, one for street, another for city, and another for the state and state of province. But given that the address is within one country, it would seem to me at first that that may be workable, but if not, then we will just need to define an RDAP extension to sort that out.
So, to add and to make what Francisco said just a little more complicated, okay, I used a particular phrase early on when I was talking about noting the language and script that's in use. And that is a critical question that the community at large should address is the granularity of that tagging. that's what's important. So to a first order, you could add an EPP extension, which would allow you to create some references to this language and script applies to these kinds of things. And that's fairly straightforward to do and could probably be done very quickly and get most people to deploy it. On the other hand, if you want to, one of the things to consider is sometimes you have mixed scripts in use or mixed languages in use. So let's take the name field as sort of an easy example. Okay, I could be a person from one country. I'll not use myself. So suppose I'm from a a Latin-based country, Latin language, of good Spanish or Italian, and maybe I marry someone who is from a kanji type of language or an ideographic language, and you decide to adopt part of those names in your last name as part of your surname that goes with it. Well, I now have a name. The name field is currently a single field, and it's your whole name. But I've got mixed scripts and mixed languages in use there, and that is not accommodated in any way in EPP. So it's a question of granularity. Do I need to know that there's two languages in use there? Maybe I don't. It's possible that I really don't care. If it's freeform text, I only care that I can identify the code points, and I'm done. But those are interesting questions that need to be asked about the policy. In an address component, a canonical example is the use of the Arabic numeral 0 to 9, which are commonly used in many other languages in script as part of address fields. Is that something which needs to be called out in some way? If I'm going to have an address element, do I need to reflect the fact that there's multiple languages and scripts in use here? If the only thing I've done is add the Arabic numeral 0 to 9, maybe I can just ignore that and that's can be allowed, and I only care about what the majority of the script and language is. So these are sort of the depth of the policy discussions about the cliched 80-20 solution that I'm looking for. How far do I want to go to this? And critical question is, what's the level of granularity that I seek in documenting the language and script? And my last comment about all of that is just to remind us, I made this comment earlier. It may be that we don't, in fact, need to know what the language is. It's possible. There's a lot of for a lot of maybe an 80% solution, I don't have to worry about what the language reference is. Maybe it's a discussion that one should have, because if I've got code point and I can look it up in a Unicode table, just means that everybody has to know all the, have the full Unicode table, it tells me what scripts that code point belongs to. And so if I've got a data element and I start to, aggregate the various scripts that are in use or could be in use given the code points that I've got, I can start to abstract and maybe infer, intuit, a lot of information. But again, it's not deterministic certainty, and that's the critical thing here. So there's a granularity question overall that has to be answered, and then that sort of guides you down how far you're going to go in this space. Thanks.
And just to follow up on Francisco's technical thing, I think the communication between the contracted parties would be simple to solve. I think the bigger technical here in quotes is being able to tag these elements, and how are we going to do that? And obviously from the registrar standpoint, I bring this up because we're going to be the ones responsible in doing it. And that technical solution doesn't exist today.
So I have 3 minutes left in the session. Any questions from the floor that we haven't addressed yet?
I would like to make a suggestion going further down the road of working on PDPs. We were really fortunate that we had Jim in our PDP working group. I would like to suggest that if there is new policy work that is going to be done in the WHOIS, that there is a way of synchronizing all the work that is actually going on related to the WHOIS, because otherwise you're going back and forth. Look, we were lucky that we had the possibility to work together in the same context and getting some input immediately into another working group to allow them to have that scope on that issue. Otherwise, you would go... Imagine that the translation and transliteration PDP would not have been there. Probably the expert working group would not have touched up on that issue. And the moment you launch the translation and transliteration PDP, you have to go back and ask the expert working group, well, what do you think about? If they have done the work, you have to restart the work. And I think we don't have to lose any time anymore in the who is so important, because that's the foundation of the route at the end. If we fail in having now a plan that would allow us to work really in depth on all the issues that are on the table, there are many. I would like to see a synchronization between the working groups so that we are not losing time going back and forth to read the reports of the others to see where are they and what are they doing. We were really lucky, and we have a good sample of it can work if there is a way of synchronizing work.
It is right there. I can think of at least two other parallel groups going on in the ICANN context on aspects of who is. And with due respect to James, I only discovered this one when I read the schedule.
I am PT9 for the transcript. Just follow up on the Rudy points that I think now we are seeing between how to translate transliterations and all that. But my personal question all the time when I'm in the working group is there any other group parallelly trying to check or validate? So we are now trying to make it like in the correct format. But as Rudy said earlier, when how often you contact the person is only when the legal process started. So the core of it is this information correct? So actually, I'm not very sure myself. Is there any other group working on how to validate? Because it's not only one time even. How often you have to validate? And if this person have 10 or 100 domains, do they have to every time validate, or they do one time and then somehow can, you know?
I'll put a plug in for a new PDP that will be starting soon. There's a board-initiated PDP on trying to determine the next generation for WHOIS services, what the new system should look like. And if you've looked at the issue report that staff has published, it's fairly large, but it's trying to encompass all of these issues in one so you have that coordination. I mean, it'll be a very large PDP. I imagine there'll be multiple subgroups going on special issues, but it's going to be done collectively and together so you don't have this piecemeal approach that you've seen in the past. The GNSO is supposed to vote on it this week. It might get deferred for another next vote, but in the next few months, I envision that PDP will be kicking off, and all of your expertise will be very, very needed for that PDP. And with that, I think we've closed the session. Thank you, everyone, for an excellent presentation, and thank you for participating in this session.